Phillips. May it please the court, counsel. As you know, I'm David Phillips. I'm arguing on behalf of Ms. Ross. I think where the district court went wrong here is it assumed that this case was very similar to the first case of this type, Hyman versus Tate, and it wasn't.
I didn't understand concretely what you thought RJM should have done, since she had given a different name.
Well, that's the problem, Judge, is there's no evidence that she gave anyone a different name. In fact, in the Hyman versus Tate case, we had the traditional debt
collection.
Well, I didn't
understand. One, the name on the in the bankruptcy is Lisa Ross, right?
The Lisa Ross, D-E-L-I-S-A. They were collecting under the name of Lisa Ross. Exact same address.
The Lisa Ross is the name in the bankruptcy?
The Lisa, D-E-L-I-S-A.
The Lisa Ross is the name on the particular debt that they're trying to collect, right?
Right, but we have no idea why it had Lisa Ross on it, because it wasn't their debt.
I know how it helps you that you don't know why it had. Doesn't your client know?
Well, she testified that she'd never used the name Lisa Ross and had no idea why they were sending it to her in the name of Lisa Ross. And this defendant couldn't produce any evidence why.
You have the burden of proof. So what is your evidence as to why the debt they were trying to collect said Lisa Ross instead of DeLisa?
We have no idea, Judge, because this was a scavenged debt. This was a debt that went from Tinkers to Everest to Chance.
You have no idea. I don't understand how you can win, because if you have no idea, then for some reason that we don't know, her name on the debt is a different name, and the name of the bankruptcy,
we don't
DeLisa,
know that.
Don't interrupt me. And the name of the bankruptcy, DeLisa, is an unusual name. So how are they supposed to find out that Lisa Ross is really DeLisa Ross?
Well, if they had given the scrub firm her Social Security number, that would have given them a dead-on match, because this was a bankruptcy back when the bankruptcies had full Social Security numbers. The scrub service also testified that they could do imperfect matches, where they've got a name that's darn near close, with the same address, same zip code, similar name, but they were set up to fail in their searches, Your Honor. It'd be as if someone looked for me on the Internet, David Phillips. Well, if you did a traditional spelling of P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S, you might find stuff related to me, but my name has a different spelling. It's one L, two P's.
Finish. So you're saying they should have either searched Social Security. So you're saying the Lisa Ross debt had the correct Social Security number?
That's right.
They could have searched Social Security numbers, or they could have searched addresses.
Or they could have searched imperfect matches, Judge.
What does that mean?
Well, imperfect matches are, we got a name of a Ross with a first name that's similar but not perfect. They could search for Lisa Ross anywhere in the country. There's all kinds of variations that they can search for. But that was one of the things that was never produced here, is exactly how this name was carried. The only thing they ever produced in discovery was a page of collector's notes that don't even have any of the information about why they claimed it was Lisa Ross.
Well, finish your thought.
Your thought's probably more important, Judge.
Why don't we go to that? Go ahead. I thought you were done with your sentence.
All they produced is a page of collector's notes. They produced none of the biographical information showing why they thought it was Lisa Ross or why anyone thought it was Lisa Ross. As I said earlier, this was a debt that went Tinkers to Everest to Chance. It was a Fingerhut-initiated debt that at some point was bought by a company called FDS that was sold then to RJM, a debt scavenger, in a big portfolio, a bunch of blips of data, basically, who then hired its sister company, Plaza, to start collecting, who then it went back to RJM, and they started collecting.
Right. Well, also, wasn't there a problem? Because when she did her bankruptcy filing, she didn't list RJM. She listed RMA. If RJM had been there, then in terms of the procedures that RJM had in place, it would have been picked up.
Well,
right?
No, it wouldn't have been picked up. They point to
It could have been picked up, because then it would have been the right company, RJM.
No, because the bankruptcy searches don't look for the companies. The bankruptcy searches just look for the people. Okay? And here, what they pointed to is they pointed to this, oh, you're using Lisa instead of DeLisa or vice versa, and this error on the bankruptcy petition must have led us astray. But there was no factual evidence to support that. There's no evidence from Plaza Associates, who was sent the bankruptcy notice, saying, we got this notice in, and this was a head-scratcher because we don't know anything about RMA versus RJM. There was no evidence from that. There was no evidence from Fingerhut, the creditor who was sent the notice, saying, you know, we were scratching our head. We had no idea. In fact, if anyone actually looked at the bankruptcy petition and had a question, a head-scratcher, about RMA acquisitions, Fingerhut, it had the control number on the bankruptcy petition that the defendant and Plaza, its sister company, were using to collect the debt. So that's all supposition and guesswork, which is where we're back to on why this shouldn't have been decided on summary judgment.
Are you saying that they didn't respond to your discovery requests? Is that part of your
appeal? Sort of.
What do you mean, sort of?
Sort of. We moved to
challenging the district judge's rulings on discovery.
There wasn't a ruling on this discovery. Because we moved to compel. We moved to compel because all we had was the collector's notes.
And what did the judge do?
That motion to compel was withdrawn because they swore in court that that was all that existed.
You don't believe them.
Well, I don't believe them because then
When you didn't believe them, did you go to the judge and ask for sanctions or some other remedy against what you regarded as their improper response?
We did in our briefs, Judge, because we found out it wasn't true when we took Mr. Maddie's deposition.
Would you slow down, please? Just slow down. Now, you weren't satisfied with their discovery response. So what did you say to the judge?
We weren't satisfied with the discovery response after we took Mr. Maddie's affidavit or deposition. And he said, oh, yeah, there's other screens.
Right. And then what do? When you're dissatisfied with discovery, you go to the judge, right?
Well,
complain.
Discovery?
Or did you?
No, we didn't. Discovery
Why?
Had closed. We were
Why
in the middle
didn't
of,
you?
We were in the middle of briefing summary judgment. We pointed that out as another reason why you couldn't take what Mr. Maddie said in his affidavit, which was their only evidence, as true. That's how we addressed it.
So there's no judicial ruling on discovery here.
That would be correct. There's just a record on the discovery requests, on the withdrawal of the motion to compel based on a representation in court, and on then Mr. Maddie telling us in a deposition that what we'd been told wasn't correct. And that's another reason why it shouldn't have been decided on summary judgment. It took Mr. Maddie 3 affidavits to get his story out there that they had this elaborate 5-part procedure. He just kept discovering procedures as he went along. And the judge credited that, but made an inference that one statement that he's had that was absolutely antithetical to their position must have been a typographical error. He swore under oath in his 3rd affidavit that he knew about the bankruptcy on a date that was prior to the bankruptcy even being filed. Now, maybe that's a typographical error. Maybe it isn't. But it's the kind of thing that a trier of fact gets to look at and judge credibility when it's a trial. You don't get to disregard that, make the inference to disregard it that it's a typographical error. And that's what the district court did incorrectly here. And that was the difference between Hyman versus Tate, the seminal case in this area, and this case, which is Hyman versus Tate was a bench trial with sworn witnesses where you got to cross-examine the witness, where they got to put on testimony as to why their procedures were reasonable, not just, here's our procedures, you have to accept them. It's here's our procedures and here's why they're reasonable. They gave statistical evidence and so forth, and Judge Kennelly in that case gave credence to it and ruled against us, ruled against the consumer and said, yeah, they do have a bona fide error defense. And one of the critical factors there was that it was a traditional creditor who immediately gave it over to a debt collector who immediately started collecting on it. We don't have any sort of, you know, Tinkers to Evers collection here. We've got the whole infield involved, the outfield, the stands, over an elaborate 3-4 year period on a debt that, as the agreement where it was sold acknowledges, we're selling you stuff.
Well, Hyman does say the defendant could have done more, right?
Sure.
You only needed reasonable procedures.
Right.
So why isn't there a search procedure, you know, the name plus the address or the name plus the security number, social security number? Why isn't that not ideal, but why isn't that
not reasonable? The reason I don't think it's reasonable is kind of the kind of debts they bought here, Judge. In the purchase agreement, it says, it has a disclaimer that the creditor who's selling this stuff, who wasn't actually the original creditor, says, disclaims the number, the nature, the accuracy, the completeness, the enforceability, the validity of any of these debts. So they knew they were buying debts that might be inaccurate. Who knows
That's
where the error...
That's mm-hmm. always true.
But here they're specifically disclaiming it.
That's a standard mm-hmm. disclaimer.
Mm-hmm. No, it isn't, Judge. Not in my experience, it isn't. In these debt scavenger cases that are going to be growing in number before this court, it is a disclaimer that sometimes is in there.
Right.
And we tried to test that disclaimer by asking Mr. Maddie, who had this elaborate 5-part procedure in his third affidavit, you know, well, what kind of due diligence did you do to look at this portfolio of debts? And the man who had all this elaborate testimony and knowledge, you know, with this crucial error in it, said, I don't know.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Messer?
May it please the court, counsel. Joe Messer on behalf of RJM. This is a case that should never have been filed and should never have been pursued because of this court's decisions in Hyman v. Tate and the Randolph case. This is a situation that matches the Randolph situation. Actually, it's better on facts than Randolph in that there was an agreement, a written agreement, between RJM and the seller of the debt that required that, first of all, made a representation that the seller would not sell bankrupt debts, and secondly, said that the seller would provide RJM of notice of any claims on any of the accounts that it sold. So you could stop right there and say that the reasonable procedure was established as pursuant to what this court has determined is necessary in the Hyman case. You don't need to go on to the next level. There were 5 different procedures that RJM had in place, and importantly, the bankruptcy scrub that's so contentious here that we've heard so much about was not even required in the Randolph or the Hyman case. In fact, the court said specifically they addressed that issue. Counsel here brought that up to the court in Hyman, and this court said no, bankruptcy searches are not necessary. And that's because...
Well, Mr. Phillips said you could easily have searched just under the Social Security number or just under the address, and then you would have discovered a similar name.
Well, my contention is that, first of all, a bankruptcy search is not required under the law. Hyman v. Tate established that there's no requirement for a bankruptcy search. So a bankruptcy search is an extra measure, an extra step above and beyond what's required by the law that this collector undertook. And, in fact, this collector did not have the Social Security number, so the Social Security number wasn't something that they could search under. They conducted a search.
I missed that.
They did not have the Social Security number, so it was impossible for them to search for the Social Security number. What they did do is they searched using the name that they had on the debtor, a name that this debtor knew was a name that was being used in a collection letter. They received a collection letter less than 60 days prior to filing bankruptcy, the debtor did, using the name Lisa Ross, yet she failed to list Lisa Ross on her bankruptcy petition, therefore just killing the possibility that this bankruptcy notice would ever get to RJM and killing the possibility that anybody's going to pick it up on a bankruptcy search. So, again, the bankruptcy search was above and beyond what's required. You had you had 5 procedures in place. As I mentioned, the contract, that covered the 2 procedures of not transferring bankrupt accounts and notifying of any bankruptcy. Also, and there was absolutely no evidence to the contrary that appellant has brought forward. The third procedure, it was the RJM's internal procedure described by Scott Maddie to cease all collection activity once they learned of a bankruptcy. And this was documented in the record. This was documented in the collector notes that this exact thing happened, that RJM followed this procedure to the T. And there's no factual dispute to the contrary regarding that. Fourth procedure was that RJM had an oral agreement with its third-party debt collector. And it's not a sister company. This notion that there's some relation, yeah, it may be that the father owns or is a founder of Plaza and the son works for RJM and used to work for Plaza. That's the only connection. It's not a, quote, sister company under the same corporate umbrella. It's a legitimate third-party collector. Plaza did conduct its own bankruptcy searches. Again, it didn't pick up the name. Importantly, though, there was an agreement between Plaza and RJM that Plaza would notify RJM of any bankruptcies that it learned of. The procedure didn't work in this case because, again, we have the name problem.
In Hyman, you say bankruptcy search is necessary, but in Hyman, didn't the bank that forwarded these things for collection, didn't they certify that there were no bankrupt?
Well, similarly, in this case, there was a representation in the asset purchase agreement that no bankrupt accounts would be transferred. So that same
the disclaimer that Mr. Phillips mentioned.
It's standard boilerplate. It's in order to exculpate somebody like the debt seller, and it's unavoidable in a situation like this.
How many debts were conveyed?
I don't know, but I can tell you that Mr. Maddie testified.
They usually come in bundles.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was a very large number. But I can tell you also that Mr. Maddie testified that, in fact, they did follow the procedure. In other words, the seller did periodically notify RJM that a debt had gone bankrupt. And the way that works is that's what RJM, of course, wants. It goes back to the Hyman Tate thing. It doesn't make any business sense to be buying bankrupt debts. They don't want that. They have the right to put those debts back, because they shouldn't have been sold in the first place if they were bankrupt. Now, this bankruptcy arose after the debt was sold. So, again, RJM, through notice to the seller, should have received, or the debt collector should have received the notice of the bankruptcy, but that didn't happen because the wrong name was used. The wrong name of the debt collector was used. RMA Associates, not RJM. RMA is a completely different collection agency. It's quite possible that Plaza took
there
that.
There is such an agency?
Yes, there is. And it's quite possible that that Plaza Associates took that notice and sent it on to RMA, not knowing that it had anything to do with anybody they were trying to collect. But importantly, you know, the fifth procedure, that RJM has an initial ongoing bankruptcy searches. The bankruptcy search process is not imperfect. It's the best possible situation that they can have given the bulk of debts they have. If they have a situation that conducts a search for every possible variation of a name, it's quite possible that they're going to get a bunch of information back on people that they have no files on, that aren't their debtors. So it really doesn't make sense to have a huge, especially when the law doesn't require it. I mean, the Seventh Circuit creates a standard for the whole nation as to what's required, and you've already said in Hyman v. Tate, you don't need a bankruptcy search. If you reverse that now and say, yeah, you got to have a bankruptcy search, and it's got to be this particular kind of bankruptcy search, this is going to flood the district court with cases, because everybody will be fighting over this bankruptcy search. It's a way to stop this problem. But most importantly, a situation, as you said, it works in Hyman v. Tate, where there's an agreement that between the creditor and the debt collector, that the creditor will let them know when there's a bankruptcy, and that it makes no business sense to try to collect on a bankrupt debt, and that you stop trying to collect immediately upon notice. All those things that occurred here, all those factual situations that exist here, which there's no factual dispute regarding, no factual issue brought up, exist. That's the law. That's the way the law should be. It's a workable system, and a system that's going to avoid flooding the system. Nobody got hurt here. Nobody gets hurt in this situation. As soon as maybe two collection letters go out, as soon as the bankruptcy attorney notified RJM by picking up the phone and calling and saying, hey, got a client here that's filed for bankruptcy, RJM ceased collection activity. Plaintiff's attorney could have done that. Our opponent's attorney could have done that in this situation. It had actually already been done, so it was unnecessary. If you look at the collection notes, collection activity had been ceased. Had they done that, they wouldn't have been filing the lawsuit, but that's not where the money's to be made. The money's to be made in filing the lawsuits. And you've got to stop this situation where people are coming in with all sorts of arguments as to what could have been done. No harm, no foul. Nobody was hurt in this situation, and the reasonable procedures worked. As far as why the district court properly ruled for RJM, Rule 56E of the Rules of Civil Procedure. An adverse party's response to a motion for summary judgment has to contain affidavits or evidence to refute the genuine issues if there are any genuine issues of fact. There were no adverse. There was no adverse. There was just inferences and just notions made up about the evidence. RJM heaped the evidence on in this case, gave it to him early on in the case in letters in order to try to persuade plaintiff's attorney to drop the lawsuit. The disclosures that were made early on in the case. This issue of the screens, the collector screens, if you look at the deposition testimony, you'll see that, yes, RJM has multiple collector screens available to it, but only a couple of them, two of them, pertained to the debtor in this case because the others were not filled out. This debtor didn't have that kind of information. Those two screens were, in fact, produced, and they were produced in a manner that allowed counsel to inquire about them. And in fact, he did inquire about them in the depositions. So it's not as if anybody was trying to hide the ball. In fact, if anything, early on, the plaintiff's counsel was inundated with information about these reasonable procedures in order to try to stop this litigation, which continued on. The Supreme Court and this court has held that where a non-moving party fails to present evidence or testimony to establish a genuine dispute, and there's no evidence in the record to the contrary, the moving party's position is the position that the court's to take. That's exactly what we had. You can't rest on speculation as to determine in denying somebody's motion for summary judgment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Messer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Your time has expired.